Lying to police about her role in helping the disgraced former minister's ex-wife Vicky Price tell her story to the media. The Police Service of Northern Ireland says it'll ask a judge for more time to question Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. The politician has spent a second night in custody as detectives investigate the 1972 murder of mother of 10 Jean McConville. He denies any wrongdoing. Ukraine is claiming many rebels have been killed in a major anti-terror operation in the eastern town of Slavyansk. Residents have been told to stay indoors while government forces try to drive out pro-Russian militants. Hundreds of people have turned out for the funeral of Adrian Mole author Sue Townsend. The 68-year-old died last month following a short illness. Stephen Mangan, who played Adrian Mole in a TV adaptation of the books, says she was a joy to work with.
A really wonderfully warm, generous, witty, she was hilarious, funny woman who, you know, genuinely touched the lives of a lot of people. You could see by the amount of people that were here today how loved she was.
And the Bank of England has warned a rapid rise in house prices could be the biggest danger to the economic recovery. One of its deputy governors has hinted the bank might have to take action if they keep going up. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
BCFM. Independent, international, just interesting and innovative tunes.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. And helping me review this week's news is the Green Councillor for Ashley Ward at St Paul's in the City Centre, Rob Telford. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, most know him as being in the middle of the 1975 Lockheed scandal, where he took $1 million bribe for the Dutch Air Force to buy US fighters that promptly fell out of the sky. His name was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, but he wasn't Dutch at all. He was a German prince, joined the Nazi party whilst at university, quickly becoming an SS officer before marrying into the Dutch royal family and supposedly switching sides during the war. But we know him on this show as the founder and the chairman for the first two decades of NATO's political lobbying arm, the Bilderberg Group, arguably the most powerful private club in the world, selecting everything from Secretary Generals of NATO to Prime Ministers and Presidents, rendering our elections almost pointless. Also, with the US taking over Channel 5's TV this week, more from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom's Granville Williams on how the desire of a handful of corporations to control almost everything we read, see and hear is spreading into the internet too. And so that's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16. A relatively sunny weekend, including nice bank holiday Monday too. Next week, highs of 16. A week of sunshine, but also showers. Next weekend, that's the 10th and the 11th of May, highs of 16 degrees, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's the Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, Rob Telford. Hi, Rob, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us exactly, where is Ashley Ward?
Ashley Ward is the area around St Paul's, Stokes Croft, Montpellier, St Werburgh, St Andrews.
Okay, and when were you first elected there?
It was actually a year ago to this very day. So it was actually exactly 1 year ago, 2013.
Okay, are either of the the councillors in Ashley up for grabs this month?
No, not this time. It's next year that Ashley Ward has its election.
Okay. Also, you're as a Green. Why the Green Party? Why not one of the other parties?
I chose the Greens because I think they take a stand on principle. I think they have a lot of good policies, particularly around the environment, but also around social justice. I think it's important. We have a strong progressive force in Bristol. I think that the Green Party offers that.
In what way, though? Because for a lot of people, yes, the main parties, they've traditionally held power without much of a challenge. But how is the Green Party actually able to do that? Because the trouble is, if people want to vote for somebody on a wider scale, say, for example, as an MP, then they're going to have to vote for Labour, aren't they? They're not going to be voting for Greens if they, say, for example, want to get out the Tories. One of the main parties, your vote counts for more. If you're voting Green in the general election is a wasted vote.
I don't agree, actually. I think that more and more we're seeing people wanting to vote Green in general elections. We're seeing more
people...
Well,
they want to, but there's no point, because they know that the Green candidate is not going to challenge the orthodoxy, because they won't stand a chance of getting in generally.
I don't agree that for a second. We've already got one MP.
One MP?
Well, yes, we've got one. It's taken a while, but we've got one. And it shows that we can win elections in a general election format. We just need to have more people joining the party and seeing that we're the radical choice at elections and backing up with their vote. It's a wasted vote if you go for Labour, in my view, but...
Martin, maybe a good time to ask you to start contributing. Wasted vote if you go for Labour. But, I mean, there is... The only reason that the Green Party has thrived is because Labour has left its original idea of being a socialist party, a progressive party, and it's actually thrown its lot in with the city largely through New Labour, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and I think the electoral system is a big problem. I mean, we did have this referendum on AV, which is not PR, the last election, which crashed, which is very, very unfortunate. But, of course, we do, in fact, have PR in elections in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, especially in Northern Ireland, because, of course, obtaining consensus there is really important. And I, as a member of the Labour Party, I'm absolutely in favour of proportional representation, because that then changes the game. We're no longer a two-party political system, if we ever were. And the problem is that a multi-party political system becomes extremely difficult to manage with a first-past-the-post electoral system. It's got to change at some point, and it probably will, because, as I say, out in the devolved assemblies and so on, they've already got PR, and eventually it will come to Britain with delay.
But why did you decide to stay in the Labour Party rather than actually join a party which is actually more in some ways along the lines you're thinking, more radical, like the Greens?
Well, I mean, I do agree with a lot of Green policies, actually, and a lot of the Green Party is saying a lot of things like renationalisation of the railways, which is very difficult to get the Labour front bench to agree to, so I'm glad that the Greens are saying that. But I am actually a socialist. I do actually believe in a degree of central planning. And I know that's not a very popular thing amongst Greens, because it's a difference of emphasis, if you like. And also, of course, I do actually see a kind of struggle between the haves and the have-nots as very fundamental to the way politics of the 20th century worked.
I don't think those are out of keeping with Green policy, and I think the idea of central planning isn't anathema to Greens. It means we do want a strong NHS, something centrally administered in that sense. I think we're seeing at the moment, you know, the Tories and the Lib Dems in coalition eroding the state, and I don't think there's any Green who would say that's a good thing. So I think your characterisations might be slightly out of date there, Martin. I think we've got a lot more going for us in terms of our sort of left-wing principles now. I think previously, I think it's true to say that we're more of a centrist party, but I think we've gone further to the left now.
Martin mentioned Northern Ireland there, different electoral system. What are your thoughts about that, Rob?
Well, I mean, first of all, I should say that, you know, the elections this month, the European elections, are based on proportional representation, so a Green vote isn't wasted, whatever you think about the whys and wherefores of what we're talking about. The simple fact is that until we get that, we're not going to get radical change. The more that we do in my party to emphasise voting Green, the more we can get a consensus for a proportional representation. Labour aren't going to do it. I mean, Martin's got a lot of faith. He's got more faith than I do. I don't think Labour are ever going to submit to it, because it's Turkey's voting for Christmas. We have to force that change through the electoral system by getting the people who believe in it elected.
Now, Martin, you mentioned Northern Ireland and the sensitive politics, meaning that in many ways they had to have a situation that wasn't a first-past-the-post type system. We've had the arrest of Gerry Adams a couple of days ago. We've just heard that police in Northern Ireland are now seeking to extend the detention of the Sinn Féin leader at 4:30. They applied to the courts today, half an hour ago. So there is obviously sensitivity there. Before we go on to talk about Gerry Adams and the situation in Northern Ireland, whether or not that's a political bit of political policing, it just explain what happens if you have the proportional representation system that we use, and also that our voters in Britain said, yes, we like this system at the last general election, because they don't want that the proportional system. What is it that? How does it affect Ireland? How did it affect Ireland?
Well, if you look back to the beginning of the Troubles in the 1960s, you had basically a first-past-the-post system in place for for everything from local elections to national elections, and there was basically gerrymandering going on. So the boundaries were drawn in such a way that there was always an inbuilt unionist majority. And of course, the civil rights movement began initially as a peaceful protest against this exclusion from political power within the six counties. And of course, then it escalated into a violent conflict. And you could argue, I mean, people see PR sometimes as a middle class issue. It's the sort of thing Liberal Democrats go on about because it's a sort of airy fairy issue for the chattering classes. You could argue that the whole fighting and conflict in Northern Ireland was about the electoral system. Mm. And eventually it was changed. Mm. And once it was changed, it became possible to build the kind of cross-community consensus which we've been living with more recently. But, of course, it's still fragile.
Well, yesterday, Gerry Adams' colleague in Sinn Féin, that is Martin McGuinness, Deputy First Minister, did give a statement, what he called the dark side of policing, what he believes. So before we hear from David Cameron, let's hear him.
I view his arrest as a deliberate attempt to influence the outcome of the elections that are due to take place in 3 weeks' time, north and south, on this island. And of course that raises very serious questions around why that is the case and what is the agenda. And it isn't that long ago whenever we informed the media that we in fact were informed ourselves by very senior people within the PSNI, people who are quite clearly in tune with the peace process, who are reformers in relation to police, that there was still a dark side within policing here in the north of Ireland. And I think we've seen that dark side flex its muscles in the course of the last couple of days. We know who they are. The reformers know who they are. And I think against the backdrop of quite clearly an agenda which has been running for some considerable time, made up of people who are maliciously and vehemently hostile to the peace process, people who could be described as former Republicans, who have been targeting the Sinn Féin peace strategy and targeting the leader of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams. It's quite disappointing to see the efforts of those people now in consort with the dark side within policing.
Well, this comment, the dark side within policing, what does he mean by that? And is there any reality to it, do you think, Martin?
Well, that's the first time I've heard the full statement by Martin McGuinness. And he's quite clear there that he's saying that there are elements within the police service of Northern Ireland that they are happy with and feel are, you know, in tune with their views, and that there are others who are not. This is worrying because, of course, you know, they're trying to establish a genuine, you know, that all sections of the community feel happy about the way the police are doing their job. And the obvious question has to be, why now, with all of this, with elections coming up? And the other point, of course, is that if we really are going to go back over this, then we need to bring Brigadier Gordon Kerr back from Iraq, where he's running the Joint Services Group on the British government payroll.
Come back from Iraq.
No, I don't think he has, because he's still wanted, I understand. He's still, I mean, basically, Sir John Stevens, who was head of the Met, basically said he'd have to stand trial as a terrorist. And basically, that didn't happen.
You see,
because he was running through the Force Research Unit the whole loyalist paramilitary campaign. So in actual fact, the whole loyalist paramilitary campaign, which killed hundreds of people, leads directly back to the British Army, a named British Army officer, Brigadier Gordon Kerr. Now, I think he should be brought back and put on trial, because that is an educational purpose for the British public. Because, of course, MI5, MI6 and military intelligence are still engaged in terrorist activities in places like Iraq. And of course, if we put them on trial for what they did in Northern Ireland, that gives them a shot over the bows for things that they're doing in Iraq and Syria.
Rob, what do you make of this? Because I think actually one of the fascinating things was that there was no mention of any kind of, you know, we think that X, Y and Z should be arrested too from Sinn Féin until today, when the Police Service of Northern Ireland have applied for an extension to keep Gerry Adams in for longer. So anyway, what are your thoughts about whether this is political policing?
I think it is. If you're taking someone of that high profile and you're doing it publicly, obviously there's no way of not doing it publicly. There's clearly an agenda there. I feel that we have to be very careful with the timelines that you're going to take this kind of action. If you're investigating something, surely it can wait a little amount of time. You can put it off slightly. It does tamper with the electoral system because people don't know what to think of this person. If something happens randomly, if something happens because it happens, you can't do anything about that. That's part and parcel of an electoral system. But I think it is important to get a neutrality just before an election. I think that's important.
Anyway, let's hear what Mr Cameron had to say about it all yesterday.
We have an independent judicial system, both in here in England, and also we do have one in Northern Ireland, and there's been absolutely no political interference in this issue. We have independent policing authorities, independent prosecuting authorities. Those are vital parts of the free country and the free society we enjoy today.
Martin, independent policing, prosecuting and judicial authorities. How independent are they really? I mean, I'm thinking particularly about Ireland after the peace agreement, and now the troubles are over.
Well, I think if you heard what Martin McGuinness was saying there earlier, he said there are elements within the police service of Northern Ireland who he called the reformers, who understand that this kind of political policing is potentially dangerous. So I think that he's treading a very fine line there. Don't forget that Sinn Féin have encouraged their people to join the police force in the last few years, and Ronnie Carroll was assassinated by the real IRA for joining the police force, even though he was in fact a supporter of Sinn Féin. And of course, a lot of the information which is being used against Gerry Adams now has come from the Republican dissidents who don't like him. And so you've got a kind of alliance between what you might call the securocrats, who just want to run the place the way that they always used to run it, and the Republican dissidents to undermine Sinn Féin. And of course, Gerry Adams is standing in the general election in the south of Ireland, in the Republic, and this, I don't think anything that happens to him will change his political standing in the north. That's pretty solid. Even if he got sent to prison for 25 years, it wouldn't change his political standing. But in the Republic, it does harm him.
Rob, what are your thoughts about what Mr Cameron, Prime Minister, had to say there? Because he's saying basically, look, no one's above the law. This is just pure coincidence that it's happened right in the middle of an election campaign.
I think Cameron is going to emphasise whatever happens. He's going to emphasise those kind of things because that's in his own interests, and he's, you know, that helps him with his own vote. I mean, we've got to remember politicians are politicians. They're going to say things because they think it appeases people who support them. On the Northern Ireland issue and Ireland in general, I did actually get a chance this week to watch all of the party election broadcasts, which might sound like quite depressing viewing, but actually, I was very taken with a lot of what Sinn Féin were saying,
and well, they are actually set to become the second biggest party in Southern Ireland at the moment. They are doing extremely well, gathering a lot of support. So that's the backdrop to all of this.
And that's, I think, I mean, being slightly cynical, that's where I think this is coming from. Is I think that there's a bit of a worry about that, and that tends to happen when someone with a populist agenda, maybe a Republican agenda, not necessarily with a clean past, by the way, but you know that's likely to happen. Is that people are going to try and stop them from getting any grasp of power?
Okay, at the speed of a speeding bullet across the Irish Sea, back in this direction, Bristol teachers resign due to new parking laws. Two primary school teachers have resigned. This is in the Bristol Post, as a result of a resident parking zone being introduced in Cotham. Andrea Crudd and Charlotte Price said they can't continue if they're unable to park close to Colston's primary school. Now, Rob, let's come straight to you on this, because this is just the sort of thing that we don't want to see with these marvellous new residence parking zones. Apparently, this was never going to happen, and anybody that had a particular reason to park there was going to be able to park there. The only people who weren't going to be able to park were the people who were just using places as, say, for example, places like St Paul's as an alternative to paying for a car park.
I mean, the thing about this is that the schools and the council need to work a lot closer together. It sounds like there needs to be provision given for these members of staff so they can park their cars. Simple as that. And that should be included within the scheme itself. Generally speaking, there are a lot of new schools opening For instance, in my ward, there's a new school opening in Montpellier. Fairlawn is becoming a new school. They're having to move all of the car park out of the school grounds, moving it onto the street, and that's going to cause issues there. So we just need to get these things right before they start, and that's seemingly what's not happened here.
But are we expecting you, as a Green, to say, hang on a minute, they shouldn't be bringing their cars? She should come along the cycle path.
Of course, if you're coming from Bath every day on a bike, even I think that is quite a long way to go.
You'd be very fit at the end of the week, wouldn't you?
I know, I used to do it. I used to work as a primary school teaching assistant in Bath and used to cycle, and that was fine for me. Other people who, you know, have much more strenuous jobs, and let's be frank, than being a teaching assistant and leaving at 3 o'clock, which is most teachers, they do need to have a bit of empathy with them. I think, you know, Redland Station is a perfectly good option there. I think, you know, you come up from Bath, come to Temple Mead, through to Redland, get off the train at Redland, maybe cycle the last little bit. And for me, that is what I'd always choose as an option.
Martin, the main issue here is that the price of these resident parking or non-resident parking permits is going to be so prohibitive, it's actually causing people to say, well, I can't work in Bristol anymore.
Well, obviously, this is something has to be done about this. I mean, it's a practical matter.
It isn't being done, is it?
No. Well, I mean, I would suggest that, I mean, if you're going to have a residence parking system, then perhaps residents should be given a free parking permit. Yeah. Never mind paying. If you're a resident, you should be allowed to park your car for free, at least one car.
Okay, also,
that could be extended to include key workers like people and people who need to be in school. I mean, I used to be a primary school teacher in the 1980s. And eventually I had to drive to work because I just couldn't guarantee to be there on time, given the problems with public transport. And of course, if you're a teacher, you really do have to be there on time. If you're in an office, you can arrive 5 minutes late and it's not the end of the world. But, you know, when the 5-year-olds, that's not on.
But Rob, from a common sense point of view, you'd have thought all the fines from people who shouldn't be parking where they are under this new system could pay for people who live there and work there to have free passes. Why isn't that happening?
That's part of it,
But they're not. They aren't going to be free, not even for residents. Nothing's going to be free.
Oh, no, sorry, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, it's not going to be free. It's £48 for a permit a year. That works out about 30...
That's to start with.
That's 13p
a
day.
What about next year and next year and next year?
What about we don't know what's going to happen next year and next year and next year?
Yeah, it's going to ramp up. I can guarantee it. That's what always happens with these sorts of taxes.
No, we can't be worrying about that for now. I think what the issue is a lot of people don't like the idea that they're going to have to walk a little bit further to their door. And I'm sorry, but that is the motoring lobby who's bringing that. It tends to be people who want it, who keep quiet as well. A lot of the stuff we found in our ward is there's a lot of people in favour of it, but they don't come forward because they're okay with it. If you're against something, you'll come forward. We've had a lot of reactionary stuff happening in Bristol, let's be frank about this. We've had people driving tanks through Clifton. We've had people, you know, carrying coffins
that's
down
Park
Street.
That's not reactionary, yeah, it's a fun political stunt.
I think it's reactionary, actually.
Why?
It's fun if...
I mean, no one's seriously expecting proponents of the residence parking zone to be hit by a tank and fired at or something. It's just a bit of a laugh, isn't it?
Yeah, well, maybe it is a bit of a laugh, but why are you getting a tank out to protest against something like this? Get it out to protest something that's going on that's really affecting people, something like austerity, which is affecting people every day, you know. But why are you getting it out because you can't drive your car a certain
place?
It's
because people feel that the forces behind imposing this on the city will give no quarter and are not listening. That's why they feel, because it's imaginative use of the frustration they feel.
The forces that implement policies like this, where it takes away some of your convenience in life, are not evil forces. They're basically saying we need to do something to cut out the
community
traffic.
But we've got two people here are losing their jobs because they won't be able to afford to pay for this.
And that's what I said right at the start, is that we need to make sure that the system brings that in. I agree, by the way, that the consultation on this has been abysmal. It's getting there now. I mean, actually, in Montpellier this week, we've had people coming and giving really amazing, positive contributions to make it a workable system. And the most important thing, I think you're right in saying, is that the cost is prohibitive for a lot of people.
Are you worried that actually across the city there will be quite organised resistance to this when it comes in? People will simply ignore it or be organised in ignoring it?
I'm not worried. I mean, I think a lot of people are threatening that. I think that's what most people do, and there's something that's a change like this. Personally, I've always been in favour of residence parking schemes because I feel that they keep cars from coming into Bristol. 25,000 new cars in the last 10 years in the Bristol sub-region. You know, something has to be done to stop that from happening.
What is the Bristol sub-region? Would you like to enlighten us? These are the sort of terms, I guess, that get bandied around up at City Hall.
Council House, City Hall sort of language. Yeah. Well, I'd say Bristol, South Gloss, North Somerset and Baines. Those areas, we've had 25,000 new cars in the last 10 years. Now, there has to be a way of dealing with
that. Old Avon area? Is that
it's basically the old Avon
okay,
area.
Including Bath?
Yeah.
Okay. So how many more cars, did you say?
25,000. So we've got to find a way of managing that. And the way, I mean, I think it should be something even more radical. We should be going for things like workplace parking levies, congestion charges, so that people really have to be forced into another way of doing things. And I know that that looks bad, because it's like, oh, there's not good public transport, forcing people onto public transport. The only way we're going to get good public transport is more people use it. Demand meets supply in this case, I think.
Okay, so we're going to have to hit those poor old motorists. Anyway, on to another green subject, which is also trying to get people to do things very differently, is wind farms. And it came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week.
Mark Lazarevich.
Before he was elected, the Prime Minister said that if they let me, he would put a wind turbine on 10 Downing Street, making use of the cheapest, most developed form of renewable energy. Last week, he announced that his party wants to end support for onshore wind, even though the government's own survey this week showed that 70% of the public now support it. What changed his mind?
He called them burden.
What has changed is we've seen a massive increase of onshore wind in our country. We will achieve, with what is in the planning system and under construction, approaching 10% of our electricity demand provided by onshore wind. So I think the question then is it right to continue to overrule local planners and local people, and does it continue to be right to put taxpayers' money in after you've built out that onshore wind? I don't believe it is, and the Conservative manifesto will make that very clear for local communities to see. Other parties will have to make their own choices.
Well, actually, what's happening here, Rob Telford from Ashley Ward, Green councillor, is a lot of people are resisting this. The idea is great. Those people say, we want these wonderful onshore wind farms. No boats can crash into them or anything. Fantastic. But when it actually comes to going through the planning system, there's an immense amount of organisation against them. And also, this is happening often in conservative parts of the country. Conservatives are wondering, hang on, if we approve these wind farms, we're not going to get an MP at the next election.
Yeah, and I think this comes down to what people see as infringing on their land, and it basically comes down to the money classes largely.
So, given that you like it, how are you going to actually get this to get some of these built?
Well, we need strong people in local government. We need people who are able to tackle these basically vested interests who aren't willing to submit basically their land to this kind of progressive development, which is what I believe it is. And if you compare, for instance, you know, the development of roads in the UK with the development of wind farms, there's never any opposition to roads except from people who are in the minority. We need more people who are prepared to put time and effort into extolling the virtues of wind farms, because they're going to provide a huge amount of our energy supply in the next 30
years. Well, it's a bit like HS2, isn't it? You know, you've got a lot of opposition to that as well. Nobody really wants any change. How are you actually going to get these wind farms, Rob? Because, I mean, quite clearly, if you don't believe in nuclear, you don't believe in coal, the Greens are against both, you know, you need some other form of energy, and this seems to be one of the most obvious ones.
I mean, I think offshore's still got potential. My view is that it comes down to communities taking control of energy, actually, and we've come a long way in that. I think in Bristol particularly, we're doing quite a lot to, you know, start that movement. And there's already an energy network where people can feed in and get good ideas from other people and start to create the alternatives in the city.
Well, the obvious thing is to try and generate power at home, isn't it? By having solar panels on the roof with a little wind power, and at least then you're starting to be able to.
That's right.
And you're not having to pay so much in the way of energy bills now from these giant energy companies. They are horrendous people, because they're constantly jacking up the price of energy, apart from when it's coming up to a general election time. And also, they're in the situation now where they're doing what was a public utilities job. And if you want to invest, say you've got 20 grand, you want to invest that in E.ON or one of these energy companies, you never have to pay for your electricity or gas again, because you're... the return on the shares will pay all your bills. And then at the end of it all, after 20 years or whatever, you've still got a massive nest egg there. So there is terrible crookedness and corruption around the whole privatisation of energy. How are the Green parties going to fix it?
Well, we want to bring public services like this one, what I think is a public service. I mean, we don't see it as that these days, which is the scary thing, like energy provision into the public sector, so that we can actually own our own energy. We don't have to submit to higher and higher and higher bills. It can be controlled. I think, going back to the wind farm issue, we're not I don't think we're in a situation where there's no wind farms going in. I think we need to be clear about that. There are some going in. And also in Bristol, can I say, we have got a whole area of the council dedicated to this, a whole area looking at sustainability and looking at how we build more sustainable homes, better heated homes, so that people are able to live for cheaper. And that's the brilliant side effect of all of these kind of green issues. A lot of the time we think of green as being a middle class pursuit, but actually it's largely something that will help people on lower incomes, because it will mean you will have to pay less to heat your home.
Martin, what about these onshore wind farms? It looks like the Conservatives are now saying there will be no onshore wind farms after the next election. It's been a new part of their manifesto.
Well, I find this really strange, because if you remember with the whole issue around the football clubs and creating supermarkets and so on, and people have protested against that, but they've been overruled. The planning system in Britain is pretty ruthless. As long as what you're doing is legal, then you can basically do it, and local people cannot complain or overrule commercial decisions. And of course what you find is that if you're in an inner city area and people want to dump a supermarket on you, you can complain, but you will get the supermarket, it'll be rammed down your throat, you'll get no comeback. But of course in rural areas where we live, the posh classes, then we have got enough clout to make sure that we don't have to put up with having wind farms if we don't want to. And it's just it's a power differential in the society, isn't it?
Okay, on to another story. And 900,000 crimes, including rape, not been pursued by the police in 2013. Nearly a million criminal offences, including rape, went unrecorded by police in a single year, according to a damning report that could see a 20-year decline in recorded crime reverse when accurate statistics are calculated. Inspectors said they suspected discreditable and unethical behaviour by some officers, and said they discovered 14 reported rapes that were wrongly categorised in a study of 13 of the 43 police forces in England and Wales, including the case of a 13-year-old boy with autism who complained of an attack by a 15-year-old friend, but the case was written off as sexual experimentation because the negative effect might have on the victim. In another case, an officer failed to record a case of rape because it involved too much work. Rob, this is pretty appalling, and it looks like our crime statistics aren't worth the paper they're written on.
No, and it is. I mean, I can't. Really, my only comment on this is how dreadful it is to hear. What we need to do is have an effective scrutiny function of the police. An independent police IPCC doesn't necessarily always do that. I think what we've got to understand is the police need someone to hold them to account.
Well, this just to clarify, this report is by the Inspectorate of Constabulary, HMIC, Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary. But the implication is that, I mean, in fact, I was listening on the radio yesterday, and they were saying, well, what's going to happen from now on every year is crime is going to go up, but it won't be actually going up. It's just because it will be more accurate in future.
Well, it's strange, because, I mean, we always hear that crime's going down at the moment. And definitely when we get the statistics through from the Avon and Somerset Constabulary, they always say that crime's going down. I think actually there's so much to be done for police officers these days. I mean, in my community, you know, there's a lot of really amazing PCSCOs, a lot of really good coppers, basically, who work incredibly hard, and the police cuts have been some of the worst cuts. Now, 900,000 crimes is a really, really shocking statistic. I don't know what the answer is here. It's a big question,
Martin,
how we deal with that.
The inspectorate said it could not establish in every case the motivation for misrecording or failure to record crime, but it said in the light of what we have so far found, it's difficult to conclude that none of these failures was the result of discreditable or unethical behaviour. So do you think that that's what's behind this?
There's a fundamental problem here, which is the police, like other public services, have been given a target-driven culture, so that they have to reach targets. So, in other words, the more crime there is, the more crime is unsolved, and so on. And it's all of their funding streams and everything is dependent on this, detecting crime and then punishing it. Now, in actual fact, the role of the police force is to prevent crime. So if the police force were doing their job 100% effectively, there wouldn't be any crime and there wouldn't be any need to arrest anybody or take anybody to court. Now, obviously, that's completely impossible. But in the past, when my uncle was a police officer back in the 1960s, policemen were given a great deal of discretion to decide what they were doing and why, whether it was worth arresting somebody, whether there's other ways to deal with the problem. They've been basically turned into robots, a bit like teachers and people working in the health service, and it's just wrong.
OK, back to Westminster and Prime Minister's questions then, and it was Dave and Ed again, the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, again talking about the privatisation of the post office.
Speaker, the post office is actually making a profit when they privatised it. And what have we discovered today? It's one rule for the postal workers and another rule for the hedge funds. And Mr. Speaker, who runs these hedge funds? They've been very coy about who runs these hedge funds. None other than the Chancellor's best man runs one of them. So why is it, Mr. Speaker? It's one rule if you deliver the Chancellor's best man speech, and it's another rule if you deliver the Chancellor's post.
What this shows, Mr. Speaker, he can't talk about the deficit because it's falling. He can't talk about the economy because it's growing. He can't talk about jobs because there are 1.5 million more people in work. So he is painting himself into the red corner by only talking about issues that are actually successes for the government, but appeal to the trade unions, the left-wingers behind him, and the people who want to play the politics of envy. That's what's happening in British politics. Everyone can see it. Nothing to say about the long-term economic plan that shows Britain is on the rise and Labour is on the slide.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that question was supposed to be about the long-term economic plan or the post office sell-off. There was a slight blurring of the edges. But anyway, Rob, what are your thoughts on the management by the Conservatives and also, of course, by Lib Dem Vince Cable of the way that the post office was sold off, floated on the stock market?
Well, actually, it's one of the rare occasions I've agreed with what Ed Miliband's saying on that one. I think he's quite right to say that it's bizarre to sell the post office when it's making a profit, because that can be pumped back into used in another way. And it seems like every time David Cameron gets asked a question in the Commons, he changes the subject. He changes it to something larger that he thinks is more important, which isn't really the point of Prime Minister's questions. He's not really being held to account. And one of the things that he's going to have to get over, if there are going to be these prime ministerial debates next year, is actually engaging with the issue that's asked. I mean, he just doesn't do that in the Commons.
And well, it's interesting that apparently the Conservative Central Office have been trying to avoid initial negotiations about what's going to happen with those prime ministerial the debates with Ed Miliband on the TV in the run up to next year's general election. But Martin, what about this the hedge fund, the guy who runs the hedge fund, who's George Osborne's best man at his wedding, seems to have done rather nicely out of the privatisation of the post office?
Well, the British taxpayer has been shortchanged billions of pounds.
Well, it's around about, it's between 1 billion and 1.4 billion.
We're supposed to be, there's no money for anything, but we can afford to give money away to the Chancellor's best man. That's the reality. And people at the bottom end of our society are being persecuted, frankly. And at the same time, people at the top are being given free handouts. Mm. That's just how it is, isn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds like that. Also, at Prime Minister's questions, we had local MP, Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie, asking a question about full employment. She seems to think, and it's great to hear Conservatives saying this, that that's the objective. Hopefully, very soon, we will have full employment in Britain.
Charlotte Leslie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The number of unemployed job seekers in Bristol has fallen by 25%. Bristol North West has fallen by 25% in the last year, but there's obviously still much more to do. I'm also hosting a jobs fair this Friday. Chancellor's welcome commitment to full employment. What else is the government doing to make this ambitious aspiration a reality?
Well, what we've seen already is 1.7 million private sector new jobs created, far outstripping the loss of public sector jobs, so there are 1.5 million people in work altogether. We've seen an increase in full-time work, which I think is very welcome because people often want to work more hours than they're currently able to. In terms of driving further employment growth, I think the clear message to businesses is you've got the £2,000 off your national insurance bill, which I think can help people to take on new employees. There's the cut to business rates for many shops in our high street, which I think is also very welcome. And from next year, anyone under the age of 21, you won't have to pay any national insurance contributions in respect of them at all. We want to see more people in work and to raise even further that level of aspiration in our country.
One of the things that he was talking about there, Martin, the Prime Minister, was the taking away of a lot of the responsibility to pay national insurance by employers and, by employers more than anything else. But anyway, 1.7 million new jobs here in Britain.
Yes, and many of them are basically self-employed, which means in effect that people are on working tax credit, so they're still receiving government subsidy. Many people in work are being subsidised through housing benefit. So there's a real question about what the quality of these jobs is. Let's just come back to this question of full employment. We haven't had full employment in Britain since the 1970s. Full employment used to be classified as 3% unemployment, maximum. And you can run an economy at full employment. We could have full employment tomorrow, but we would have to either increase borrowing or increase taxes on the wealthy to pay for it. They're talking about, even the Labour are talking about, creating jobs for people if they're unemployed for more than 1 year. Now, what you've got to understand about that is creating jobs costs money. Paying people benefits is cheap. Once you start to try and help them and give them a job, you've got to get your chequebook out. And all of the economy, what's going on in the economy at the moment, is based on quantitative easing. Remember that? Mm. Remember that? We're printing money. Britain prints more money than any other country per head. And we've got a housing bubble based on 5 years of zero interest rates and money printing. This will crash. There is no doubt about it in my mind, none whatsoever, and it's not just because Britain's being mismanaged, the world economy is being mismanaged, there is going to be a crash, and the Labour front bench had better get their heads around that, because they may be in charge when it happens.
Okay, Rob, before you deal with or don't deal with Martin's prediction about crashing, which he's been doing for the last 3 years, maybe it may be tomorrow, who knows, maybe never. What about this idea of Charlotte Leslie's of full employment in Bristol?
Well, it's a good idea, isn't it? I mean, Charlotte's got a history of jumping on board with good ideas. That's basically her stock in trade. She jumps on any issue that she thinks is going to get her publicity. That's her prerogative. I'm very interested, though, in what she would define it as. I mean, I think Martin's provided a very good sort of explanation there. How does Charlotte Leslie believe that jobs are created? Does she believe that we should be creating good jobs for young people in the private sector or in the public sector? What's the balance? You know, where are we going to, you know, enthuse and encourage the young people of Bristol into employment?
Well, I would imagine the private sector, because quite a lot of jobs have been lost in the public sector, and as Mr. Cameron was saying there, 1.7 million new jobs already in the private sector. Mm. That seems to be the growth area, at least according to the Conservatives.
Well, I'd like to see a reawakening of public service in this country. I think that a lot of young people are really desperate to serve other people and provide things for people in a very, very good way. And I think what I'm trying to say is, Charlotte could perhaps be championing something like the Enterprise Zone, for instance, in near Temple Meads. It's like this whole, you know, it's all this curate's egg. It's good in parts, because what it could do is it could provide local jobs for young people where they can go straight from university, straight into, or straight from college, straight into the Enterprise Zone. What can we do as a city to encourage that kind of movement and encourage that kind of yeah, happening, I guess.
Okay, AstraZeneca, we hear yesterday or a couple of days ago, is rejecting Pfizer today, actually, rejecting Pfizer's bid as US pharmaceutical giant courts UK government. This is from The Guardian today. AstraZeneca has wasted little time in rejecting a new takeover bid worth £64 billion from Pfizer after its US rival took the battle straight to 10 Downing Street. David Cameron declared the government had received robust assurances from Pfizer on UK jobs and investments. We should be really proud of AstraZeneca, but of course the decision on any merger is a decision for two companies and their shareholders, he said. He spoke to AstraZeneca's chairman, Leif Johansson, shortly after Pfizer's improved offer was received. Right, two two massive pharmaceutical giants, one US, one British. It looks like this US one, Pfizer, is going to take over AstraZeneca, and the Prime Minister seems to be happy about it. Now, I just wonder whether this is like a bit of... I'm getting deja vu here about Kraft taking over Cadbury's and all the guarantees we got from Kraft. Martin, what are your thoughts about this takeover bid? Because it is massive, isn't it? We're talking £50 a share, but I think I'll just get the price, but what are your thoughts?
Well, this whole culture of hostile takeover bids is actually wrong.
£64 billion they're going to pay for it, apparently.
Yeah, and of course this is how managers are trying to maximise profits is through takeover bids rather than investments in their own firms.
Right, so they're taking over the competition, so then they can start to set the price.
Yes, and in actual fact, there's a very strong case for the nationalisation of all drug production. Mm. If you think of the main cost of the NHS. Is paid to AstraZeneca, Pfizer and similar organisations. And of course, they wouldn't be able to make a profit at all if the NHS didn't exist. If it was all down to private sector, people buying their own drugs if they could afford it, half the population, at least half the population, couldn't afford to buy drugs, so that would put that they've got a captive market there with the NHS. But of course, the NHS then overspends because a large part of its money is spent on buying in drugs which are often patented. They've got a very bad record in the developing world, where they refuse to let people use generic versions of their drugs. And there's an overwhelming case, I would say, for the nationalisation of all drug production and for it to be done for not-for-profit at all.
I mean, I get the idea
nowadays. That's not Labour policy,
but
by
these
the way.
Big corporations, giant corporations like Pfizer and Kraft, Rob, are actually almost like tanks. They're like sort of panzer divisions of the modern world. They don't send in the tanks, that they send in the big corporations to take over, but they take over nevertheless.
Yeah, and it's a shame. I mean, I want to see more and more smaller businesses being set up and thriving, because that's largely, they are more efficient. They actually provide more
income. Well, that's nice, but this isn't the way things are going, is it? You're going to end up with one giant pharmaceutical company that will control the market, and then nobody will be able to start small ones.
Well, that's quite right, and I think that's the dominant system we have. Capitalism is something that needs to be questioned at all times.
It's a bit like the supermarkets, isn't it? You know, where you've got the giant supermarket comes in and all the little shops are doing that have to close.
Yeah, well, I think this actually is quite interesting because it shows a difference of emphasis here. I would argue that the technology involved in producing drugs is such that you can't really have lots and lots of small firms. It doesn't make sense, which is why you end up having concentration. And if you're going to have concentration, ultimately you have to have nationalisation. I would have a nationalised drug industry in Britain run by the government and not lots and lots of small firms. I'm a socialist.
Okay, another story this week. Care homes, the known and the unknown. Pretty shocking panorama on Wednesday. Expose of Essex's old deanery care home. Once you've absorbed the revelations, though, according to the BBC, it's natural to wonder just how widespread such abuse is. Andrea Sutcliffe, the Chief Inspector of Social Care, has been quick to say it's a minority issue. She's undoubtedly right, but what the regulator doesn't know is just how big a minority. And before I hear you two's thoughts on that, let's hear from somebody who I would advise anybody who's got elderly relatives in these care homes to join this organisation. It's called the Relatives and Residents Association. So let's hear from the chair now. That's Judy Downey.
There are lots of good homes and there are lots of absolutely brilliant workers, just as there are lots of good people, but we also need a police force. And it's terribly important that the regulator does their job thoroughly and often, and we shouldn't have reduced the frequency of inspections, and at present we shouldn't have new regulations going through Parliament that make, I think the word is, light touch. Providers will no longer have to bring complaint systems to the attention of residents and people acting on their behalf. They'll no longer be required to report serious incidents to the regulator, as we had in the old regulations. They will no longer have to analyse incidents that resulted in or could have resulted in harm to the residents. We've got a situation where some very poorly trained staff, and who might be badly trained, but we also know that if staff are badly treated, there's been lots of reports about that, saying they tend to feel devalued and not respected. We've got a system where some of the most vulnerable people that have been discussed in your programme, heartbreaking details of people's needs, are being looked after by a system that has no mandatory accepted decent certificate for training, and also no minimum staffing ratios. What would we say if people said about our kids, you can be in a class of 50, 60, doesn't matter, the person's really sweet, really nice, really likes children. We wouldn't put up with it. We think it's discriminatory against older people that these things are still going on, and the government is still saying lighter touch. In the past, the providers of every single care home in the country used to have to nominate one of their directors to go in every month to check that the home was as it should be, as the regulations said they should be. That representative of the provider had to write a report, send it to the regulator and to the manager of the home and to his fellow directors or her fellow directors or partners. It had to be done so that they couldn't say, we didn't know, we weren't there. Or we're going to put CCTV in because we can't work out what's bad. If they had to go in and check, you know, we're going backwards where care of older people is concerned. It's astonishing that with all the information at our disposal, we still don't seem to get this right. And we know it's only by having firm and strong regulation and training our staff and valuing them. We know that that matters. We know that when people are well managed and respected, it's a tough job, and a lot of the workers are an absolute delight and work well beyond the call of duty. But we have to make sure that we don't talk about all workers as though they're all torturers and pathological, because most of them won't be.
Well, some pretty shocking stuff there from Judy Downey from the Relatives and Residents Association, Rob. The situation really being that there's been a massive deregulation. First of all, a lot of this care used to be done by the state. It's now done by the private sector. And then there were a lot of guarantees put into place to make sure the private sector did their job properly. Now a lot of those guarantees are being taken away.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, I've experienced of people who I know who have been care workers, and their conditions are pretty poor as well. You know, you don't get paid sometimes for going overnight and staying at someone's house in order to care for them. Sometimes you're asked to step in at a moment's notice. The conditions aren't good for the workers. Never mind the terrible situation there is with many people who are elderly and need care. So yes, I think we do need to. I mean, I think what she said was completely right. Is that we need to go back to the government and say, why are you calling for this lighter touch? There needs to be action, and there needs to be something done to regulate the people who are in charge of this.
Well, the Relatives and Residents Association, who I only came across for the first time this week, wonderful people. They say they support, inform, and campaign on behalf of older people in care. They've got a website called RELRES.org, and it costs £25 a year to be a member. I think if you've got elderly relatives, they're probably worth it. Martin, why is it that we're in this situation where there's an old lady calling out nearly 100 times for help and no one is answering her?
I don't think that things like looking after elderly people in homes should be done for private profit, because there's always a temptation for people to cut corners. And of course, what they're trying to do is have care workers who are on the lowest possible salaries. So if you think back a few years ago to when they privatised home care in Bristol, because they used to have their own in-house home care teams, they got rid of them because they were too expensive. They were paid £9 an hour. So they, of course, the people who are doing it now, it's not really the private sector, of course, because it's all public money, but they're doing it for less than that. Now, the people doing this kind of job need to be very well paid, because it's very antisocial hours, very difficult work, and they need to be absolutely dedicated to the job. And it's actually going to cost money. And you know what? I think George Osborne's best man needs to get his chequebook out and pay some more money to look after these people properly.
Okay.
And other people like him.
An exclusive in The Independent this week, actually last weekend on The Independent on Sunday. Local authorities have a conflict of interest on fracking investments. Councils that will play a key role in deciding the future of fracking in Britain have investments worth millions of pounds in companies behind the energy extraction method, The Independent reveals. Local authorities in areas identified as potential sources sources of gas have holdings via their pension funds in firms seeking to drill within their boundaries. One of the most significant investments is nearly £2 million held by Lincolnshire County Council's pension fund. In Total, the French company that earlier this year became the first oil major to enter Britain's dash for shale gas, which, by the way, was a Nazi idea back in the 1940s when they were absolutely desperate for oil and just about to lose the war. With 30 million, that doesn't say that in the article, that's just my comment, with a £30 million stake in two exploration projects in the county. Rob Telford, you're a Green councillor in Ashley Ward. What do you make of this? Because it looks like councils, possibly even our own, have got some sort of vested interest in fracking going ahead.
Well, I should say, first of all, that we had a really good debate in the council recently about fracking, and the petition that was brought had over 3,500 signatures. So there's clearly public interest in Bristol, at least, in the activities. And in terms of the pension funds, it is shocking there are these conflicts of interest, but I'm sure that it's not just fracking that this is a conflict of interest. There's probably loads of other companies that have got investments in Bristol where there is a conflict of interest, and we have to make decisions about major applications, and fracking is just the tip of the iceberg, probably.
Martin?
Well, I think fracking is actually a bubble. It's been hyped massively in the US as a solution, for example, to the Putin turning off the gas taps in Ukraine. But there's no evidence to suggest that it's actually viable. I think it's only viable because the oil price is where it is, and if there's a crash, the oil price will go down, and then fracking will become unviable, and the bubble will burst.
And what about other possible investments by council pension funds in things which are actually large parts of that council's policy?
Well, the wage earner funds in Sweden, the economist Rudolf Meidner pushed this forward in the 1980s. Wage earner funds would take 1% of everybody's salary and 1% from the employer, and then they would gradually buy out Swedish industry. So, and they would be controlled by the trade unions. That was the pension fund socialism, as they called it. But of course, the people that ran industry went absolutely nuts and refused to allow it to happen. But it's absolutely feasible that using pension funds, British workers could buy out British industry over a 25-year period. Why don't we do it?
Well, good question. Final story this week. Musicians hit out at the ban on guitars in British prisons. This was on Monday in The Guardian. Banning of steel string guitars in British prisons has come under fire from a group of prominent musicians, including Billy Bragg, Johnny Marr, Dave Gilmour and Richard Hawley. In a letter published in The Guardian, the 12 signatories urged the Minister for Justice, Chris Grayne, to overturn the blanket ban on the instruments, which they believe undermines the important role music has to play in engaging prisoners in the process of rehabilitation. The ban came in as part of the government's changes to the incentive and earned privileges policy for prisoners in November last year. Rob?
It just boggles my mind. I mean, why would you want to do that? It's just,
well, I imagine it may have something to do with the strings being used for suicide and that sort of thing, and possibly being used as a weapon.
I think that's wholly unrealistic, in the sense that it would presumably be a guided exercise, that there would be other people around. I think this is just another instance of the government not realising what human rights are.
Okay, Martin?
Well, they're trying to ban books in prison as well. I mean, how crazy. They're saying
that you cannot send new books into prison, although there are books in the prison library. Right, so you can go, although there are lots that aren't allowed in that prison.
So I don't suppose they'll have Das Kapital in the prison library, will they?
I think what they're saying is that there are lots of books in prisons now that are not allowed to be there, so they don't want to have to pay extra money for every book that comes into a prison to be looked at. Don't you think that's fair?
I think people in prison should be allowed to read books and play guitar. Call me a liberal, but I think it's all right.
Rob, what about your thoughts on this? What about this, the scheme that's used in prison? I mean, a lot of people interested in prison labour do criticise it.
Well, I just don't understand it. I mean, I think prisoners should have voting rights. I mean, this was something that was brought up last year or so.
Okay, well, that's Rob Telford. He's the Green councillor for Ashley. We'll see you after the news. We're looking at Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, celebrity publicist Max Clifford has been sent to prison for 8 years after being found guilty of a series of indecent assaults. Andy Hayes reports.
Max, to your far left.
Arriving at court, there was no apology from Max Clifford. Reporter Tom Parmenter says there was no remorse either as he was sentenced.
Max Clifford has turned and smiled to the public gallery before being led out of the dock.
DCI Michael Orchard says the case has encouraged victims to come forward.
We've seen a significant increase in the number of sexual abuse allegations reported to the police.
The NSPCC's Alan Wardle says Clifford was a manipulative person.
Someone who thought he was untouchable, someone who abused his power, and he's got this